Thank you so much, Bob. A really fantastic presentation. And we'll open up to questions. We have about half an hour or so for questions. I just wanted to quickly flag for those of you, in case anyone has to leave early, there's a survey on your chairs or that will be shared on the webinar. And it's just always helpful for us to have these, whether or not you've attended events before. You can just leave them on your chairs or leave them on the table out there. All right, so we traditionally often take a question from online, from our webinar audience, as the first question. So why don't we do that, and then we'll come back to the in-person audience.
Thank you, Julie. I've got a couple questions about specific rice varieties from Sambakawa in Liberia. Are you also working on rice that does equally well in salty mangroves and in freshwater lowlands, like you did for drought and flooded conditions? And for marketability, any mention of rice in sub-Saharan Africa that's resistant to milling breakage?
Yeah, I probably went over a little bit fast. I was conscious of time. But yeah, we are specifically working on incorporating very high levels of salt tolerance in rice, in commercializable rice varieties. If freshwater has electric conductivity of zero and seawater has electrical conductivity of around low 50s, mangroves will be around mid-20s to 30s. We're developing rices that will grow happily in about electric or EC levels of 30 to 35. Which is very salty, so that's in mangrove areas. I do want to make sure that that as salt-tolerant varieties are developed, that mangrove swamps aren't cleared to grow rice, because that would be an ecological problem, to put it mildly. But the salt tolerance is something very important in these areas. The head rice recovery or milling recovery or milling breakage is a big problem with rice. One of the nightmares of breeders is to develop a high-yielding rice that, when it is polished, it breaks apart into crumbs. Rice, as my picture of the rice grain showed, people like to eat whole grains, okay? And the way it feels in the mouth and all of that are very important. Wheat you grind up, and maize you grind up pretty much into a flour, so it doesn't matter what happens when you process it. Rice, it's very important that the grain remain intact. And there is quite a bit of variation within rice in its ability to tolerate polishing. And so we pay a lot of attention to rice that stays intact, and that's a very important trait.
A question here in person. We've got one. And if you wouldn't mind sharing your name and organization as well.
Hi, I'm Dr. Noemi Voglozin. I got my PhD at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And I did my research on African rice, Oryza glaberrima, mm-hmm. and how the genetic diversity of Oryza glaberrima is related to environmental variables in Benin, mm-hmm. West Africa. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for your presentation, but I haven't really heard you talk about Oryza glaberrima much. And we all know that Oryza glaberrima is the second species that is domesticated, but it's also really endemic to West Africa. But I would like to know what your organization is doing to make Oryza glaberrima as known as Oryza sativa. Because Oryza sativa is grown all over, is grown worldwide, yeah. Whereas Oryza sativa is grown only in West Africa. Yeah. But Oryza glaberrima has a lot of really great characteristic, mm-hmm. that might be used,
sure.
Helpful to
yeah. varieties.
What does your organization is doing to help
Great.
With that?
Yeah, we're actually doing quite a bit. We're working with Africa Rice in Benin. The main thrust of both our work is to take the traits of Oryza glaberrima. It's one of the relatives of rice, and as she indicated, was domesticated independently in West Africa river areas or swampy areas. It has many traits, and we are doing interspecific crosses across Oryza glabrema and Oryza sativa to move traits from glabrema into sativa. And the question of actually a breeding program to improve glabrema, that's more in the arena of Africa Rice Institute. We ourselves are not doing that. But in all honesty, almost all the focus is on moving traits from glabrema into sativa rather than improving glabrema itself.
Yeah, we've got a couple of related questions. The first is from Madeline Smith. Can you talk a bit more on the behavior change research focused on the acceptance, market approaches, or incentives, et cetera, to increase the uptake at scale of golden rice? And the related question is from Roma Roszynski from Boku University in Vienna, Austria. I wonder about the societal acceptance of golden rice, since rice is such a key element of cultures in Southeast Asia. Do housewives and kids like it? Any experiences?
Yeah, I think we've there are two components to the acceptance. One is, I suppose there are three. One component is taste. Is there any taste difference from golden rice? A second would be its appearance. Is there anything about the golden color, yellow color, that would put people off? And then the third is, for some, it being a GMO. We've done studies with golden rice, taste panels under red light where white rice and yellow rice are indistinguishable, and there have been no taste differences. The appearance, all of our surveys indicate that whether rice is yellow or not, if it's not off-colored brown like it's gone moldy, if it's just a nice clear yellow, people find no problem with it. Matter of fact, they're intrigued by it. And if you go to just about any market in Asia, you will find rice that is already colored yellow, saffron. So it's not outside the norm to eat a yellow rice, and that's something. So surprisingly enough, our research into acceptability, et cetera, around the color yellow indicates that with a little bit of public awareness about the health benefit of golden rice, we're not expecting much resistance there. The issue around GMO, again, it's going to be a communications issue. Once golden rice passes all the regulatory processes, there is no safety or health issues. It's a question of what sort of propaganda the anti-GMO lobby will launch. And that's something that we're obviously thinking about and how best to deal with that. You don't want to be in a situation where you're saying that. I mean, it's a very challenging prospect to think about how to deal with the anti-GMO lobby, because they're not constrained by facts or truth, so that makes it easy for them. And then you don't want to be in a situation of denying something, no, I don't beat my dog, sort of thing. We have a lot of work going into this in communications development and that sort of thing, but we really don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, because we want to make sure we have a product that farmers will grow and that will be productive enough before we get in too much into the communications. And I'm frankly disappointed, honestly, by a lot of the work that our friends who are pro golden rice go out and make a lot of noise about it, and we don't have a product that's ready yet. I'm going to be quite honest. I mean, and so people are getting all their expectations up, and we're saying, well, hang on, it's going to take a while. And it's just the nuts and bolts of getting a rice variety that will yield enough that farmers would grow and get a decent income. Nothing to do with anything about golden rice per se. It's just the rice breeding challenge in general.
My first question, my first question, and I'm John McMurdy from here at USAID. Mm-hmm. My first question is on the trajectory of hybrid rice, mm-hmm. and you know how that is or is expected to affect kind of rice seed systems. Yeah. My second question is, as long as we're talking about controversial things, USAID has a few programs in its missions that is supporting SRI projects, System mm-hmm. of Rice Intensification. I think it would be interesting to hear Erie's position on that
sure.
for the group.
Yeah. Hybrid rice is something obviously transformed rice production in China. It was a government-mandated technology. Hybrid rice in the tropics, for various reasons that are not completely understood, doesn't perform as well as it does in temperate areas. We are working, and we have a consortium of private and public, to try to improve the productivity of hybrid rice in the tropics. The private sector typically is not interested in the rice seed sector because farmers can save their own seed, and private sector is used to the model of hybrids where they sell seed every year and they have a guaranteed revenue stream from their hybrid sales. And so the private sector is attracted to a hybrid rice model, but farmers aren't really that attracted to hybrid rice because it just doesn't, be quite honest, and some of my breeders would kill me, but if you look at the adoption rates of hybrids in India, where they've been pushed for 20 years, since the early 90s, the adoption rates, and when you take away where there's a subsidy, farmers aren't taking them up, and the farmers are not idiots. They're not going to take up a technology that's no good, or that doesn't provide for them a benefit that is commensurate with the cost. I think that there is reason for optimism. We can develop better hybrids, I believe, that are attractive to farmers, and I think they're of interest. For a couple of reasons. One, it's much easier to manipulate traits with hybrids. You have much more flexibility in varietal development with hybrids, so that's attractive. And frankly, the private sector, I think, is needed to have a dynamic seed industry. And I'm working with some companies to try to develop a viable seed model or seed industry that doesn't demand hybrids, but it's a tough sell. So I think that hybrids will play a more important role in the future. But it's not a trivial thing. SRI, that's the System of Rice Intensification, something that was developed by a Jesuit priest in Madagascar in the early 90s. I actually saw it when I visited Madagascar there in the early 90s. Popularized by Norman Uphoff, a guy I worship at his feet in terms of his communication skills. The concept started out as a very rigid, prescriptive approach to intensifying rice production. And I won't go into all the details, but it was a very strict recipe of what you need to do. And if you do this, you will get higher rice yields. Every component of SRI is known through classical agronomy work over the past 50 years to contribute to improved rice yields. That's never been a question. The question has always been around SRI one notable exception. You could not use mineral fertilizer. You could only use organic fertilizer, manure, or composted plant matter. The problems around SRI are not that if you do it the way you say you do it, you'll get higher yields. Nobody questions that. The question is it practical? I mean, many of the restrictions are so strict that farmers don't or cannot adopt them. Labor demands are too high. almost no farmer has enough animals to provide a necessary nitrogen using manure alone. You have to be a very wealthy farmer to have that much manure. Labor required for weeding, hand weeding, you have to be a wealthy farmer. To control your, you need very, very precise control of water to be able to add water, remove water, add water. Almost every rice farmer, as soon as they get water on their field, the last thing they're going to do is take it off. Okay? And they've got the water, thank God, you know, and then take it off and put it on again. So it's the practical application of SRI that's the problem. And then the other issue that is just a major irritant to almost all of us is spectacular claims of outrageous yields of 20 tons a hectare, 25 tons a hectare. I mean, it's physiologically not possible. But so, you know, but what I like about SRI, and I think that we need to take out of the positive page, out of many positive pages, out of the playbook, is that they have engaged NGOs and the sectors and the government to go out and engage with farmers. And what that means is that regardless, farmers are paying closer attention to their crop. And when farmers take up, you see these adoption figures of SRI, it's always modified SRI. It means they add a little nitrogen fertilizer, change the spacing. Well, we don't actually remove the water. We transplant two or three seedlings instead of one, et cetera. But the point is that they're paying close attention to agronomic practices that they weren't paying attention to before. And that is all for the better. So, there's a question back there.
We'll shoot back to our online audience.
This question comes from Duncan Bowden from Michigan State University at the Feed the Future Food Security Policy Innovation Lab. You mentioned that policy is important for technology uptake. What do you need policymakers to do, and what tools and communication channels do you find most effective in reaching them?
I think one of the biggest challenges around for policymakers, well, there's a set. We have many different countries, a lot of well-intentioned policies, but I think are counterproductive in terms of subsidies for inputs, fertilizers, subsidies for irrigation water, et cetera, that lead to misuse of these inputs, and they're not sustainable. So I think we need our policymakers to take a hard look at their incentives and what they're actually trying to incentivize. They all want, you know, enough rice. I mean, if we like to say, if the price of rice rises, ministers of agriculture fall. So all these policies around to try to keep people in their jobs at the political level, to put it crudely. But I think a reassessment of our policies around inputs, and I would include the enforcement of pesticide regulations. We're seeing a resurgence of misuse of particularly insecticides across rice growing areas in Asia, particularly following the rice price spikes that started in 2007 and 2008. There are plenty of regulations on the books around controlling how pesticides are sold, et cetera. They're not being enforced. And we're seeing outbreaks that are pesticide-induced in rice pests. So I would say one of the biggest policy areas that I want governments to take pay attention to is rationalize your policies and regulations around inputs, and that includes subsidies, et cetera. Second, I think that's really important, and it's a tougher sell, is rice trade. I'm a real advocate of free trade, open trade in rice. Governments do everything they can to try to make sure that they have enough rice for their own country. And that means that you have a very opaque market. The rice trade is thin enough as it is, I think around 10% maybe. Up to sometimes 14% of global rice production is traded. And nobody knows really how much rice is produced. Nobody knows how much is entering the trade. Governments, they're the biggest exporters, can block exports like that. What triggered the crises in 2008 was that in late 2000, mid 2007, Vietnam, the world's number two rice exporter, blocked its exports because it was worried about food inflation, canceled contracts. India, world's at that time number one rice exporter, blocked its exports, and so immediately the rice trade seized up. Nobody knew how much rice was available, and if governments can come in and disrupt the trade, you basically have anarchy in the rice trade, and so prices are unpredictable. Some people will make a lot of money, but you know who will be the ones who lose? It'll be the poor people, as usual. So I would like to see, and we've been working with ASEAN and Asian Development Bank to try to look at how we can create a rice exchange, at least for Asia, so you could have a rice market. And yes, futures market would develop, etc. Some people would speculate. That's fine. Let the speculators win and lose. But if we could develop a rice exchange in which farmers could participate, we could have a situation where we could open up the overall rice market. So, two big policy areas: the inputs, and the second one, the rice trade, rice market.
We have time for a handful more questions. I know you had one before.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Chris Delgado. You've really partly answered the question, but I want to push you a little further. I mean, given the problems of getting the private sector, particularly the formal mm-hmm. private sector, interested in selling rice seed, and given the concentration of the production in the Asian tropics, what is the right strategy for the public sector really to pursue to get the private sector to take over increasingly a share of the burden and kind of a second green revolution?
Yeah, what I'm arguing is that I think we need to move away from the mega varieties. One of the consequences of the Green Revolution that basically swept over irrigated rice or where areas where there was good water control was you just had a handful of varieties grown. So one variety or two varieties might have been on 30 or 40 million hectares, okay? And farmers could save that seed. Not much was coming out. And you didn't have much, to be quite honest, a lot of innovation in the rice variety turnover. So what I see is particularly is that we see many different traits becoming available. We're looking at the what's going to be coming out of the sequencing program. What I see happening is that we will be more finely slicing the rice growing environment and the rice market. A much wider variety of quality characteristics for different market segments, much finer attuning to different rice production environments. This is a recipe that will encourage the taking up of rice seed production by small and medium seed companies. The multinationals won't be interested in it. But if you go around Bangladesh and eastern India and west and all over India, there's a lot of small companies that are growing vegetable seed, they're growing cotton seeds, et cetera. And they would like to produce rice, but there's nothing in it for them. So what I see, sort of my dream, is a situation where the public sector creates a flow of new traits coming in. These can be incorporated into many different varieties that are for niche markets, that are plenty of profit margin for small and medium-sized seed companies, partitioning the environments and actually enriching the overall rice production environment, and something that would be attractive to small and medium-sized seed companies producing inbred rice seed. Enough of a stream of new traits coming through, there'll be enough innovation, enough motivation or incentive for farmers to buy new seed. They may not buy seed every year, but if they buy seed every other year or every third year, there are so damn many of them that there'll be a big enough market. Okay, and so that's, and I've talked with a number of small seed companies in eastern India and in Bangladesh, and they're really interested in this model, and they think it'll work. And they're dying to get their hands on new materials. What they don't want is to be producing, Swarna sub 1, we created the flood tolerant varieties. I mean, that was produced in 1978. And it's still out there. I mean, farmers like it, but, you know, it's not a great variety. It's got a lot of problems. You know, the seed companies don't want to be producing a variety that's been out there for almost 40 years. They want a new product. And I think what's coming out of our sequencing and phenotype area, I think we can actually reinvent the rice seed industry. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right, we'll take one more from online.
Oh, I've got many more than one, but hopefully we can follow up with you after the seminar.
Sure.
A historic question for Bob as the Director General of ERIE. How much of the Green Revolution in Asia should be attributed to ERIE's technology advances, and how much to the concurrent shift from water buffalo to power tillers? Without that adjustment, would it be possible to cultivate enough area in a timely manner to take advantage of the technology?
God, that's a great question. No, it's a great question because what people don't understand, and this person clearly does, is that there's a whole set of other revolutions that take place. And one of them was the mechanization. And I would say that the original two-wheel power tiller that actually enabled a lot of this was actually designed at ERIE. A very cheap one. Kubota refuses to fund ERIE's work because they can't get into some markets in Asia because our stupid little power tiller that's so cheap is the one the farmers use. But more importantly, threshing. The ability to thresh a crop. If you're used to getting a ton and a half and all of a sudden you're getting 5 or 6 tons of rice, and instead of getting one crop a year, you're getting 2 or 3 crops a year, and one or two of those crops is when it's raining, the ability to thresh that grain is a real challenge. And there are a whole bunch of associated technologies that accompanied the higher yielding varieties. There was the tillage, the need to till land in a timely fashion. There was the ability to thresh, just to name two. And those two, and therein lies the real secret of the Green Revolution. It wasn't just more grain. It was developing an entire economic sector in the rural areas. Machinery shops to repair those tractors and sell them, spare parts. The thresher, who makes the threshers? Who stores the rice? All of that. All of that is what, it's an economic revolution. And so that questioner really hit the nail on the head. You can have a transformational technology, but it is accompanied by a whole set of other technologies that enable that to function. You know, somebody investing in a power tiller wouldn't work if they were getting only a ton of rice a hectare. So they feed back on those. It's a beautiful, and books have been written about it, but it's a great question.
I think we have time for just one final question in person. I know I had seen you raise your hand a while back, so.
My name is Sophie Kelly, and I'm a AAAS fellow with the State Department Africa Bureau. And I was wondering if different rice varieties vary in their capacity to be stored for long periods of time. So like, for instance, things like mold or breakage in storage. So when you're considering, you know, increasing the yield of rice, and I realize that, you know, a lot of this rice will be consumed immediately, but
yeah.
Is storage a factor?
Yeah, storage is certainly a challenge. And to my knowledge, we have not looked at genetic variation of storability. The key to storage life of rice are the conditions that it is enters into storage. Has it been dried properly? Is it down to a low enough moisture content? And then the actual conditions of the storage containers. Will they keep insects out? Will they keep the humidity down, et cetera? So it's more how the grain is handled. And I confess, I don't think we've actually looked at the characteristics that would determine storability. We have looked at differences in if you dry rapidly, will the grain crack and then break in milling? And there are differences in that, but it's pretty complex genetically. And I would guess that the actual starch chemistry could determine how fast a grain would dry. But again, it's all back down to moisture. What is the grain moisture when you put it into storage? You know, it has to be below a critical level. And then, to a large extent, oxygen for insects. So.
All right, we are at the 11 o'clock hour. And so I'd like to thank Bob again for a really fantastic presentation.
Well, thank you. Really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for your attention. It's been fun.